Good morning. It is 10 o'clock. The House State Agency and Fraud Oversight Committee to order. Sorry, I got the wrong thing. I am delighted to welcome you all here. And before we get into the substance of the day, we are going to approve the minutes from our last meeting. Vice Chair Anderson, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair. I'll make a motion to approve the minutes as is.
Is there a second? We don't need a second. Mm-hmm. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. All right. Our first, the order of business today is that we are hearing from the Department of Human Services on the Housing Stabilization Services Program, and then the Integrated Community Supports Program. Then we will move to public testimony and member questions. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did want to raise, there was just a concern I wanted to raise and a question to ask as we get started. So when the hearing was noticed up, or since the hearing was noticed, there have been a couple of significant announcements that have been made. You're running for governor. Congratulations to you. Governor Walz is running for re-election. He's announced that. And I have the concern, this is an incredibly serious issue of integrity of our public programs. Obviously, we've had legislators run for office. That's a regular thing. This committee, though, is different in that it's not a committee that has a substantive policy jurisdiction. What we've done is we haven't had bills referred to us or voted bills out. What we've had is testimony from executive branch folks and a questioning of them, and then testimony and questioning from folks who have criticisms of the executive branch. Which raises concerns for me about just sort of the inherent conflict of having that happening in this committee. And I guess as a particular example, just a minor one, I know that the agency was asked to present on these two really complicated programs that we don't have human services expertise in the committee, and they'd asked for 45 minutes. They were told to keep it to 10 minutes. That's obviously, as chair, Madam Chair, you have the authority to control the committee hearing. And also, as a candidate for office, there's an inherent conflict there. And so I guess my question is, do you have a plan for, will there be someone else taking over the committee, or sort of what will be done to avoid that conflict in terms of how the committee works in questioning the
Thank you, Chair Pinto.
Thank you.
I don't see a conflict. I am an elected representative of my district chairing this committee. The governor is an elected governor of this state. He does not plan to curtail his governor activities, and I do not plan to curtail my elected representative activities. And we have conducted this committee in a completely respectful and tried to be bipartisan way, allowing lots of time for both sides, a lot of questioning. The problem has been when agency personnel come in here and filibuster, and we can't get to members' questions. So I reject that, and I appreciate you raising the concern, but I think you will be gratified by how we continue to conduct the business of the committee. And I would like to note for the record that this hearing has been noticed since last June, and today happened to be the day when I get a call at 7:30 and the department announces they fired the person responsible for housing stabilization services and homelessness, and that person is not available to testify this morning. And then I get a call from the governor's office announcing their fraud package revisions are announced today while we're having our hearing. So if there's any grandstanding going on or trying to hide the ball, it is not by this committee. Thank you.
Chair Robbins, before we begin, may I correct the record?
You may, once we proceed with your testimony, you are not recognized. So, members, as I was saying, we are going to have a committee hearing today with DHS about the Housing Stabilization Services Program and the Integrated Community Services Program. I'm sorry, I'm going to finish my statement. And so we welcome the commissioner and her staff with us today. Thank you very much. And we welcome our public testifiers. We are going to proceed immediately after I hear from Chair Rarick.
Well, I just want to correct the record from not Chair Pinto, but Lead Pinto. Also, the fact that we did hear bills in here related to fraud. So I believe we heard, I believe you presented bills in here. So we did hear bills in here, Madam Chair.
Yes, we heard bills. We will proceed. Commissioner Gandhi, welcome to the committee. We look forward to your testimony. This is an ongoing, difficult topic. We really need to dig in and find out all the problems in the Housing Stabilization Program and the Integrated Community Supports Program, and we look forward to your testimony. You may begin.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Shireen Gandhi, and I was appointed as temporary commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services in February 2025. I just want to first begin by correcting the record in that, as a courtesy, I have been making calls to our committees of jurisdiction, and as well as you, Chair Robbins, as chair of the fraud committee, since we were appearing today, to let you know that the appointment of our assistant commissioner has ended. And so that is the proper terminology for a appointed official and the status of employment with DHS. It ended as of yesterday. Thank you again for the invitation to appear in front of this committee. I believe it is the fourth time DHS mm-hmm. has been asked to come in front of this committee since its inception in the last legislative session. The agency has been an active partner in the committee's work during the legislative session and over the summer. We've made our staff available to you, Madam Chair, as well as to your committee staff. And we have continued to respond to requests and will continue to do so. And I am appearing today to continue to collaborate with you on this really important topic. I know that there are three things at least we can agree on today. Minnesota hates fraud, you hate fraud, and DHS hates fraud. I want to remind everybody that DHS is taking a zero-tolerance approach to fraud. We are committed to program integrity, and we are committed to fighting fraud. And people who are stealing from public programs are really harming the people who are most in need of those programs. And we are committed to continuing our enhanced investigations, our enhanced data analytics, our quick investigations, and quick and thorough, and engaging law enforcement partners to prosecute these criminals, because that is the separation of our duties. We are an investigative arm, and then the law enforcement does the final investigation and prosecution. Criminals and the various schemes they've concocted have become more coordinated and sophisticated, and it's time for us to catch up. While single actors and individuals used to be more of the norm, now what Inspector General Clark is sharing with me and our law enforcement partners are sharing with us is we are seeing more organized bands of providers gaming the system in concert. Since I took the helm at DHS 7 months ago, every level of our agency has been engaged in the investigative work to fight fraud. Our old processes that were based on the type of fraud we used to see are not sufficient for these coordinated schemes. In the 7 months that I've been in this role, I have been engaging teams from across the agency in this intensive work to fight and prevent fraud, to strengthen our internal controls. We've done a lot of work, but there is a lot more to do. And we will continue to be transparent about what we're finding and what more we have to do. After the past few months, we've also been working across the enterprise with other agencies and the governor's office to identify additional tools and steps that we can take to prevent criminals from trying to exploit our programs that serve vulnerable adults and children in Minnesota. The executive order issued by the governor today gives DHS additional authority to move forward with disenrolling inactive providers, putting a temporary moratorium in place for new provider enrollment, creating unique identifiers for providers to track across programs,
referring bad actors to the Department of Revenue to investigate tax fraud, and creating a statewide OIG work group using our new data sharing capabilities and more. In terms of your request for information on our two programs, Housing Stabilization Services is a Medicaid service. It is distinct, separate from the state-funded housing support program that provides rent assistance. The Medicaid service helps people with disabilities find and keep housing with using various methods. It is for Minnesotans who are 18 years of age or older with incomes at or below 150% of the federal poverty level. We have approximately 21,000 individuals and 1,800 providers, roughly, that are enrolled. There is a handout on this program, and with the short time frame, I'm going to leave it at that for Housing Stabilization Services. For Integrated Community Supports, or ICS, this is also a Medicaid service enacted by the legislature in 2019, providing supports to adults 18 or older living with disabilities. ICS allows people to live independently in community through residential, provider-controlled apartment settings. As of late August, there are 260 ICS providers and 487 approved ICS settings, covering about 2,800 individual ICS units. ICS fills the gap in the service continuum between a person living in their own home and more restrictive settings such as group homes and assisted living, which the state has been moving away from as assisted living models geared for older adult populations don't offer as much client choice in how or if the clients receive services. So that's briefly an overview of those two services, and I would like to ask Inspector General Clark to talk about the fraud schemes that we are seeing.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Inspector General Clark.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm a little under the weather this morning, so bear with me if I'm coughing. I'm James Clark, and I'm the Inspector General at the Department of Human Services. I came to DHS in late March, but I'm no stranger to Medicaid fraud. Before coming to DHS, I spent nearly a decade at the Attorney General's office where I investigated and prosecuted civil, administrative, and criminal Medicaid fraud actions. The past 6 months at DHS has increased my passion for fraud prevention work, and like the commissioner, I take a zero-tolerance approach to fraud in these programs. I want to be very clear on this point. I will not tolerate any fraud in our programs. I will do everything in my power to detect and prevent fraud. Payments will be shut off immediately at the first signs of fraud. All credible allegations of fraud will be referred to law enforcement, and I will do everything in my power to kick fraudsters out of our programs. I also want to be very clear on another point. Greedy people and businesses have learned how to exploit our programs. It's an unfortunate reality, but this work is serious and challenging, and I sincerely want to partner with you all and everyone else responsible for Medicaid oversight. We have a shared responsibility, the legislature, managed care organizations, law enforcement, and quality providers that are doing good work. I want to work with everybody on these serious and challenging issues to find real solutions to these problems. I also want everybody to know that fraud is getting more complex and sophisticated. At the Medicaid Fraud Unit at the AG's office and here at DHS, we're seeing webs or rings of connected providers that are working together to commit fraud. I've seen indications of fraudulent AI-generated healthcare records. There are entire agencies as opposed to individual employees committing fraud. That means that fraud is the business model. It's not a rogue or one-off employee that is committing the fraud. I've also seen businesses committing fraud that have tentacles throughout the Medicaid program, right? When you see a HSS provider committing fraud, they may also share ownership with an autism provider, an adult daycare center, an ARMS provider, right? So you can see tentacles of fraud throughout the department. It's complicated, and it's a difficult problem to solve. As for housing stabilization services fraud schemes, I have not seen any unified HSS fraud scheme. What I've seen are schemes are varied. I've seen billing for services when the recipient has never heard of the business. I've seen overbilling, for example, billing us for 2 hours for a short phone call. I've seen providers not having any documentation to support services that were provided. I've seen also billing for non-reimbursable services, such as billing us for employee travel time, which was not reimbursable under the program. Also, I've seen upcoding, right? Billing for a more expensive service. So saying you provided a consultation and billing for a consultation when actually you provided a less expensive service like a transition service. I would just like to note, before we go to the next slide, as for HSS, we have 120 open HSS investigations. We've suspended payments to 115 providers. These providers have been sent to law enforcement. Law enforcement's been notified about these providers. As part of our investigations into the program, I've asked our federal contractor to do a top-to-bottom review of HSS billing data to detect any anomalies that signal fraud, waste, or abuse, and I expect preliminary results next month from that top-to-bottom review of HSS billing data. These investigations are complicated and they are time-consuming. We have to go line by line through billing records, we have to review treatment records, and we have to contact recipients to see whether or not services were provided. It's complicated, takes a lot of manpower and hours. We are working as hard as we can and as fast as we can to shut off payments everywhere that we see fraud. Go to the next slide.
I'm sorry, just to quickly refer, how many have you stopped payments on to date?
115 providers.
Chair Robbins.
I know. I would kick it back to the commissioner.
Okay. Commissioner Gandhi.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. This slide provides a high-level overview. As Inspector General Clark shared, he and I have both been working to understand the timeline of what has transpired with HSS so that we can make changes to DHS's internal controls and processes, as well as to continue keep taking quick action to identify and investigate fraud, stop payments as fast as possible, and make referrals to law enforcement to prosecute these criminals to the fullest extent of the law. So this timeline provides high-level information on HHS actions, reforms, and new processes. There's a lot more items behind this, and if we want to get into that during questions, we can. But at a high level, I want to flag on this slide that we began investigations in the fall of 23. We began engaging MCOs and CMS to investigate this in the spring of 24. Patterns began to emerge throughout 24, but again, it still was not what we learned by employing enhanced data analytics. So, then in 2025, during legislative session, as I began to see the numbers, the amount of spending that was happening at Housing Stabilization Services and how that compared to the forecast that we had expected, I asked our teams to begin doing data analytics and to and we had also received some vague, credible allegations of fraud, but none specific to a provider. I mean, we had the regular community tips that were coming in, but we were told that there was widespread fraud, but not who it was. And that was in the spring of 2025, this year, after I became temporary commissioner. So that's when we went to our data analytics team, as I've discussed with you before, in the Inspector General's office and said, let's start doing the types of analysis that credit card companies would do. Let's look for trends. Let's look for outliers. We don't have all the tools for predictive analytics, but that's what we're, you know, that's where we would like to get to. And so that's where that information provided Inspector General Clark and his team information, a priority list to look into, because this is very time intensive and takes many hours and a lot of work with our old outdated systems and lack of robust fraud fighting tools. When I saw that in April, I decided that both HSS and EIDBI need to be designated as high-risk Medicaid programs. That gave us additional administrative tools to act on those programs. We are required to give 30 days notice, so in early May, we gave notice to providers that those programs were going to be high-risk programs effective June 1. As we continued to look into what we were finding in housing stabilization and hearing from Inspector General Clark as well as the U.S. Attorney's Office, Attorney General's Office. I'm not sure if the U.S. Attorney provided this feedback to us, but both the Attorney General's Office and our Inspector General's Office felt overwhelmed by the amount of fraud that we were seeing in the Human Services Housing Stabilization Services Program. And so at that time, I made the unprecedented and very difficult decision to ask CMS to terminate that program.
Thank you, Commissioner. If I could just ask, where are we at on that? I know when you requested the termination, there was a 30-day period and people could provide comment, and then there was another period where they got to review the comments. So when, in fact, will the program be terminated?
Yeah, I can tell you that at the earliest, it will be terminated October 20th. We have to let the 30-day comment period end, and then as quickly as possible, we have been looking at comments that are coming in and reviewing them, but as quickly as possible, we have to take the next steps with CMS to provide them with what we heard, and CMS ultimately will work with us to determine what the final date is.
Thank you. Please just keep us informed on that. Thank you.
Yes, we will.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I have a question. You said that you first looked at numbers in the spring of 25, and yet actual numbers about the growth of the services, and yet the growth started years before that. It was 42 million in 21, and it was 74 million in 23, and it was, you know, over 100 million in 24. So, and there were concerns from counties, Hennepin County. So did no one at DHS look at this then until the spring of 25? Because that's what you said earlier.
Yeah.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Thank you, Chair Robbins, and thank you, Vice Chair Anderson. Yeah, I was speaking to my role as temporary commissioner, stepping into this role and having ultimate final authority for these programs and them being properly run. So that's what I was talking about. I know the program areas, the community, others were coming out of the pandemic. We're seeing such a great need for homelessness, supporting people who are experiencing homelessness to become housed. I know there was a lot of attention being paid and DHS being asked to process applications for providers faster. James and I are still, you know, looking into what happened before, more specifically, our appointments in this role ended. I mean, it began.
A very quick follow-up.
No, I think.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Robbins.
Do you want us to stay here?
No, maybe we'll skip so that you, I mean, that's basically what I said on the other slide. I want to make sure that we keep to the timeline here. So for the past 7 months, we have continued to take bold action. And here is how we are doing things differently at a high level. In March, I brought in a new Inspector General, James Clark, who has a decade-long record, as he shared with you, in prosecuting Medicaid fraud in the Attorney General's office. In April, I designated both EIDBI and Housing Stabilization Services as high risk. That was able to take effect June 1st. That tightened requirements on owners, increased on-site visits, and allowed us to make unannounced visits. We are staffed better. We are more strategic and effective on data analytics as a result of both reprioritizing work of our internal staff and allowing our staff and working on staff capacity surge strategies. Also, the enterprise has come to our assistance, and in September, we were able to bring in 5 additional data analysts from Minnesota Management and Budget, their results management team. And these individuals are trained to look for new patterns and anomalies in billing and payments for state services and are using AI to supplement their review and find outliers. We started looking at programs in new ways to identify outliers so that we could be strategic with the limited resources we have and focus on where we're most likely to find fraud. We started acting much faster and much more aggressively in looking at the data so that we could rise to the level of finding credible allegations of fraud and stopping payments immediately. As we've discussed, in May, we had 1 Housing Stabilization Services stop payment, and by August, we had 115. That large change came about because on May 9th, we had a meeting with the Attorney General's office and the BCA to talk about fraud and what we could do to act faster with what we were seeing. We had a past practice of waiting to stop payments until investigations had concluded. And investigations are time intensive and were taking too long. So we flipped that and decided we were going to stop payments as soon as there was a credible allegation of fraud, not wait for the investigation to conclude unless our law enforcement partners asked us to not do that because that would jeopardize their investigation. So all of us agreed that that was the right change to make given what we were seeing. And then on August 1st, I asked CMS to terminate Housing Stabilization Services. That process is underway, as we discussed. I do want to say before I close on that there is a need for Housing Stabilization Services, and we recognize that. We will be working to provide providers and counties and our partners with resources that people can be referred to when this service is terminated. And we very much would like to work with the legislature, and as James said, with providers, with the community, and others to redesign and relaunch the benefit with the proper controls in place. In the end, it's going to take all of us working together to build the program with the right controls on the front end, the right outcomes on the back end, and internal controls and program integrity throughout. We have to get it right for the taxpayers, for the people we're serving, and for the providers. And it's going to take all of us doing that together. So now I would like to turn it over to Inspector General Clark to talk a bit more about what he's seeing and how the Inspector General's office is changing.
Thank you, Inspector General Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the Commissioner mentioned, since I came aboard in March and at her direction, we are doing things differently and prioritizing our work differently. One tool that I'm leaning into that's essential that the department leans into in order to do our work faster and better is data analysis. Since I've come on board, we are taking a more thorough review of billing data to identify red flags. We are also looking at our provider networks and data related to our provider networks to ensure that we are only doing business with quality providers. We want to work with good providers, but if you're inactive or there's no need for your services or you're greedy or you're not providing quality services, we don't want to work with you. We need to be proactive in the fight against fraud. When I came on board, DHS, and we still are primarily a tip-based investigation system. Responding to tips is important, and we need to react to tips, but we can't just take a reactive approach in our fight against fraud. We need to be proactive. We do not have the resources to have investigators looking over the shoulder of the 300,000 providers in Minnesota to make sure that they're billing us correctly. We need advanced data analysis to detect red flags and anomalies, and that's the direction that we are moving towards. As I mentioned earlier, I asked our federal contractor to do a top-to-bottom review of HSS billing data for red flags. So we will need to lean into data and business technology solutions even more to keep up with the pace of the work that we are being asked to do. So this slide contains information about the shared responsibility for Medicaid data analysis, right? DHS, we do our own data analysis in-house, but we also partner with external vendors, federally mandated contractors like the Unified Program Integrity Contractor and the Recovery Audit Contractor, which we engage with on data analysis projects. And we also rely on the investigative and data analysis capacities of our Medicaid managed care partners. You can go to the next slide. The commissioner touched on this briefly, but I wanted to highlight that since I started, since the commissioner brought me on board, since I've gotten direction here, we are more aggressively than ever suspending payments to providers. Now, being aggressive comes with risk, and it can jeopardize investigations. Under Minnesota law, we have to notify providers if we suspend payments due to fraud allegations. I've seen it before. If providers catch wind that they are being watched, they can destroy records, they can delete emails, they can delete text messages, and they can tamper with witnesses. So there is a risk to acting fast, right? You have to weigh the need to proactively shut off money as fast as possible with the risk that you're also going to have to notify providers, and then they can start, whether it's using AI, tampering with witnesses, they can start inventing a whole world of services that they provided. But since May, I fully understand those risks, but since May, our process is now to suspend payments immediately once fraud is seen. Previously, we were waiting to suspend payments until investigations were completed or until law enforcement accepted a referral. That process, like I said, the investigation process into Medicaid takes a long time, right? We're looking at billing data line by line. We're looking at provider records. We're going on site. We're doing interviews. That can take a long time. So we have changed that approach. We are proactively suspending payments at the first sign of fraud. Nevertheless, we're continuing to collaborate with law enforcement. I'm leaning into the strong connections that I have in law enforcement here at the AG's office and at the federal level. And I have taken an open book approach with law enforcement. Anything you need from me, anything you need from the OIG Inspector General, I'm an open book. Data, documents, experts, I will get it to you as fast as possible to assist law enforcement investigations. However, before the priority was to protect criminal investigations, now the priority is to immediately stop potentially fraudulent money from going out the door. There is risk there, but I think it is the right approach to immediately stop money and not have these investigations play out over several years. You can go to the next slide. So what is still needed to address provider fraud? A lot. We need to have closer relationships and more oversight with managed care organizations. I want to make sure that they are doing everything they can to prevent and detect fraud. To that end, I met recently with compliance and investigative staff at Blue Cross earlier this week, and I look forward to strengthening our relationships with all MCOs to make sure we are on the same page, breaking down silos of communication, sharing information where we can to ensure there's strong oversight over the Medicaid program. this might be the fifth time I've said this, but we need better business technology solutions and upgrade. We really need to modernize our program integrity technology. Given the seriousness of our responsibilities, ideally we would have the same technology and capabilities as the private sector does to prevent and detect fraud. That's just simply not the case right now. I also think the legislature should look into strengthening our payment withhold authority. It is a tool, like I've said, that I am leaning into to shut off money at the soonest sign of fraud. I think we also need to look at expanding our authority to potentially suspend payments to businesses that have their licenses revoked or suspended. If we are revoking your license due to noncompliance with the law, I find it funny that we're in a situation where we still have to pay you money, even though we are going to revoke your license and kick you out of our programs. It's also, can you go back? It's also just true that we need to have enhanced internal controls, such as we need to have the ability to do prepayment review, right? We can no longer just solely rely on a trust-based system for Medicaid payment. There are some providers that we could just not trust. So we need to be in a position to say, you actually proved to us that these services were provided, proved to us with documents, records, and, you know, the recipient that these services were provided before we pay you. We also just need to do more auditing and data mining and closely reviewing data to enhance our internal controls. I think it's also a good idea to have an outside consultant or an audit. On the slide, it says an external gaps analysis to identify where gaps exist in our anti-fraud efforts and how our organizational structure can be better aligned with program integrity efforts. Last, and I think this is most important, we have a provider vetting problem. We need to make it much, much harder for fly-by-night unqualified providers to gain access to our programs. We need increased vetting on the front end, whether that's statutory changes that makes it easier for the department to say, hey, you are too risky, we do not want to do business with you, or hey, you're too risky, we're going to put these specific controls or oversights in place. One example of that was what got passed last session, which was a pre-enrollment risk assessment for the Housing Stabilization Services Program. To the extent we can do that, I would like to see some sort of risk assessment, capability across these programs and statute. Like, the department just should have the authority to assess risk, say, hey, you have no history of providing these services. We don't think you have the financial capability to do this. You have no financial literacy. You're just too risky to provide, to have access to all this money that you could potentially bill us for. So that's all I have for that slide.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation. I appreciate very much the new commitment to stopping payment earlier, not waiting for the end of the investigations. I understand the risk that may pose to certain investigations. And if you need statutory language so you can do it without notifying them that it's per se a fraud investigation, I would be happy to work with you on that next session. I am not familiar with that language, so I'm happy to work with you directly on tightening that up. I do have a couple questions to start us off here. First of all, one of your most recent things, Chair General Clark, was that you want enhanced internal controls. And internal controls is what I want to focus on this hearing, so that you can do prepayment reviews. I have had multiple conversations with CMS at the federal level in the last month, and they tell me you already have that authority. You can impose a prepayment review. So I don't know if there's some sort of miscommunication between you and the feds, but they have told me on multiple occasions you have that authority and you are not using that. So I think we should maybe get on a conference call or something, but my understanding is you can and should be doing more of that. And then secondly, with the pre-enrollment risk analysis, again, my understanding is you could do that already. So could you speak to why you think you can't do that?
So
Do you want me to start?
I can start. I mean, to answer your question, it's my understanding we got funding last session to start prepayment review. So we are in the process of contracting with an external vendor to start. I mean, it's just work we've never done before. So we need to figure out how we're going to do it and how we're going to implement it.
But you've always had the authority. In your statement, you said you didn't have the authority.
Well, then if I did, I misspoke. I think we can implement it. I mean, I don't think we need, like, legislative approval to do that. So when we're talking about internal controls, I'm talking about things that we can fix internally, right, that would better help us in our anti-fraud efforts. So if I misspoke, I'm sorry.
Thank you. My last question for this little bit here is you also talked about I have so many questions. This I found curious. You said that you did not have specific providers. This might be to more you, Commissioner Gandhi. You said that you were hearing reports of fraud with the housing stabilization, but that you didn't have specific providers. And I have a file folder here of emails to your department identifying specific providers from 2024 that the MCO was flagging, very specific. And so can you square that circle for me? You say you didn't have specific providers' names, but yet we have, you know, document after document saying they were trying to alert you. Could you speak to that?
Yeah. Chair Robbins, thank you. I tried to be clear. I think I wasn't clear since you're asking this question. So what I was saying is we started with a few, what we call community, Inspector General Clark calls community tips. So it's this information being provided to us that there's potentially fraud, and it's coming to us and somebody's giving us specific information. And those started to come in around fall of 23. We had more in 24. What I was speaking to in spring of 25 is that we also received a community tip that, but it had no providers attached to that community tip. And that community tip was telling us that there was more widespread fraud than coming in through the community tips, the individuals where people were giving us provider names to check into. And so that frustration, that knowing that there was more, but we didn't know who, was part of that impetus to say, there's got to be a better way. And let's start doing data analytics. Let's enhance our data analytics to find the trends and outliers so we can get to the who.
Thank you. I'll move on to Representative Elkins. Thank you.
Thank you. A quick question for IG Clark real quick. Have you at this point been able to come up with any kind of a rough estimate of the dollar value of the fraud, what you've caught so far?
So what I can...
Commissioner Clark, or General Clark.
What I can say is that for the 115 providers that we've suspended payments to, those providers in total have billed us about $100 million in fraud, $100 million over 6 years. So that's like the universe of money we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Now, the exact amount of that universe, which is actually attributable to fraud, right? We're seeing a mixed bag in our investigations, right? You have a provider, maybe they're doing some legitimate work, maybe they're not doing some legitimate work. It's a mixed bag, right? So that's the universe. But I would anticipate as investigations, administrative and criminal play out, Ultimately prosecutors or a court of law will determine exactly from that universe how much of it is actually fraud.
Okay, and then following up.
Yes, one more follow-up. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think the theme of this presentation is really stressing the fact that we have been working in the dark ages with the technology. And I think everybody at this table knows pretty much how bad the data systems that DHS uses. I did a tour. Well, let me go back. So the last presentation we had, Commissioner Gandhi presented a list of the, like, 8 different data sources that a frontline county worker would need in order to evaluate a Medicaid application. So I went out to the Dakota County Service Center and sat with the trainers who teach the frontline workers how to use the existing systems. And my goal was to go out to figure out if there were insights into ways that we might be able to streamline that collection of that data so that it would come in more accurately in a way that we could process applications more efficiently. And I never got that far because when I sat down with them, the first thing they showed me is that the vast majority of their applications are being processed through a system called Maxis, which is a 1980s-era DOS application. Instead of taking, like payroll information from Deed, which collects it on a quarterly basis from every employer in the state, they had to key information off of payroll stubs. And if they, fat-fingered something, they'd have to start over. They had to enter it separately for each program that the person was applying for. And I was just appalled. And you look at the technology that just generally that we're using, and one of the things that, you know, strikes me as somebody who worked as a data professional doing business intelligence work for the largest part of my career is that there's no way that we're getting the data that we need to, identify and shortstop fraud. The way Mr. Clark is describing what we need to do today, the we have not been making the investments that we need to do that. We're dealing here with a program that was instituted under the previous administration with a Republican legislature. We did do some tightening up of the rules this year. We did not fund, however, any improvements to the analytics. And so these guys are cobbing together, from MMB internal sources, the ability to do a better job. I know Eric McCool, who's in charge of that program, really sharp guy, knows what he needs to do. But, if we want to see substantive process on tightening the stuff the way Mr. Clark describes it, we're going to have to step up to the plate and make some investments as well. We've spent a lot of time on this committee, talking about what's wrong, but we really haven't spent any time talking about what is it that we're going to need to do as a legislature in order to give these guys the tools to get around this problem. Obviously, the fraudsters themselves are becoming much more sophisticated. That's a huge theme that we're hearing today. We have to keep up. We need to be, if the fraudsters are going to use AI, then we need to be able to use advanced analytics as well. And we need to step up and give these guys the tools that they need to do their job. So we've got an all new, the temporary commissioner is new, the IG is new, the guy in charge of, Eric in charge of the analytics project is new. We've got a good team here. They're smart people. They know what needs to be done. We need to give them the tools to do it.
Thank you. Before we continue, I see the question list is growing. We're going to move to our testifiers. So I would like to invite Rachel Lean up, and then Kane Pence will be second. Thank you all for your testimony. I hope you'll stay around in case we have questions after the public testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Lean. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Rachel Lean. Good morning, everyone. I first want to thank this committee for having me attend this oversight hearing today. My hope is that providing the statement, others will feel empowered to use their voice and speak their truth. My name is Rachel Lean, and I am a woman in long-term recovery. I am a mother, a daughter, a friend, a sibling, and a leader in the recovery community, and have done a lot to change completely the life that I once lived. Most importantly, I am a human being. I came in contact with a housing stabilization provider, Brilliant Minds, when I was graduating from treatment. I had already found housing, signed a lease, and needed help with moving and obtaining household items and getting an electric bill taken care of. All things that I thought an HSS provider was supposed to help me with. I texted the number and was immediately met with a response from someone that said they could help me. The fact that someone was so eager to help me seemed authentic because that is a heart I have for helping others too. Unfortunately, trusting this organization was a mistake. I never met with anyone from this organization, never spoke to anyone on the phone, only text messages. When I questioned the organization about why they weren't helping, they showed up at my doorstep with a vacuum cleaner, and I never heard from them again. In July of 2024, I began working as a recovery navigator at the Minnesota Recovery Connection. During this time, I began to encounter many participants with similar stories when it came to HSS. Most had signed up when leaving treatment in hopes of finding permanent housing and had essentially been ghosted by the organizations. This motivated me to get a hold of my own insurance claims through UCARE to see what I had been billed for. I went through those records and found that not only had Brilliant Minds billed me for over $2,000 and only provided me with a vacuum cleaner, I discovered that another housing stabilization provider named Leo Human Services, LLC, was billing me for the entire 10 months that I was in treatment. Every week for 10 months, Leo Human Services was lying and saying that they were meeting with me. This amounted to over $14,000. I had never heard of them, never spoken to them, nor did I ever meet with them. Finding this out angered my soul. I know what I went through to find permanent housing, and I know because I did it on my own. Once finding out this information, I contacted my insurance company and DHS. I left a voicemail on the fraud line. I received a phone call back from DHS on November 20th, 2024. DHS asked me a few questions and let me know that if they needed any additional information, that a senior investigator would call me back. In February of 2025, I contacted AJ from Care 11, and he began investigating based upon the information I had provided to him. Within days of my story airing in May, a senior investigator finally called me back. I can't help but think that if I had not contacted Care 11, would we even be here today discussing this? I want all of you to know today that I am one of the lucky ones when it comes to victimization and the predatory behavior of housing stabilization services. I am someone who was able to access the appropriate resources in order to catch and confirm that there was something very wrong. That is exactly what I did. But what about the thousands upon thousands of other Minnesotans who may not have this access? This is precisely how HSS providers have preyed upon people for years now. I promise you there are no limits when it came to who they were preying on. It could have been someone like me, your neighbor, or any community member you see outside without homes to this day. I think I speak for everyone in the recovery community when I say that we are sick and tired of the rampant fraud and people getting rich off the backs of our addiction. Even as someone who accessed the proper resources, compiled all of the evidence of fraud through my medical insurance, and sent it to DHS, it was still not enough to be heard. My question to DHS is this: by your standards and policies, what is a credible allegation of fraud? Why was I not someone who was credible enough to be listened to the first time, even with all of the evidence that I had provided? This is not the first time in a fraud case that DHS has done something like this. I implore you all today to please think about that. When all this first came to light for me as a victim of this program, I was angry for myself and how I got taken advantage of. Like I said before, I am one of the lucky ones. I have a home. I have a place to eat meals. I have a job now. I have the things that I need to live my daily life. There are people who are not as lucky as me when it comes to stuff like this. That is why I am now even more angry for all the ones that are still suffering the repercussions that they didn't ask for once they decided to trust an HSS provider. With this anger comes real motivation to make a change and be a voice for those who don't have it. That is why I said yes to coming and speaking in front of all of you today. My hope is that by doing this, others will tell their stories and real change will be made so something like this never happens again.
Thank you, Ms. Lean.
Thank you.
You raising your voice and speaking out is making huge changes throughout state government, and we really appreciate it. So on behalf of the committee, we appreciate you standing up and speaking out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pence, please join us at the testifier table.
Do I have to turn this on, or Good.
It's already on. So please state your name for the record and then begin your testimony. And just as a reminder, the committee staff had recommended 2 minutes for testifiers, so try to keep it short. But we want to hear from you, so
brevity
thank you.
Brevity is the soul of wit. So thank you, Madam Chair. When I was a young man...
I'm sorry, could you state your name?
C-A-I-N-P-E-N-C-E. When I was a younger, healthier man, I was actually a political theory major in Washington, D.C., and when I used to go for long walks, I'd go by the National Archive, and outside there it was written, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. So thank you. This is what is needed. There needs to be people who are eternally vigilant, and I 100% agree with that last lady, what she said about the media. Channel 5 did a story on me, and after a year of trying to contact DHS and explain to them the massive fraud that is going on at ICS, the next day they happened to call me. I find that to be more than just a coincidence. I ended up by a strange series of events in ICS, and I'm just telling you right now, a couple years from now, you're going to be having a committee hearing for the same thing that happened with HSS, happened with autism, happened with Feeding Our Future. There are people who don't have housing, including myself, so they come into one of these ICS that gives them a rebate on housing and promises them service. So it's really a housing program masquerading as a service program. And what they do is they charge this unbelievable daily rate. I brought all the billing record, if anybody wants to meet with me afterwards, $276 a day in my case, and they don't do jack. They do nothing. So they give you a rebate on the rent. In my case, it was an $1,800 apartment I was getting for $600. And within 5 days, they make up for it by charging for all these services that they don't give. And there's a lot of people in the program who need things who don't say anything because they're scared of the providers. They threaten you. They intimidate you. They tell you you're not going to have housing. And well, I come from a group of men who fought for America. My father actually went to prison over Vietnam. My great-grandfather was a decorated Marine. My great-great-grandfather fought in World War I. And I said, you're not doing this to me. I'm not a wimp. And I fought back. Of course, I was called a racist. I was called a fascist. I was called all these names. Why? Because I wanted groceries. Because I wanted my place cleaned. And how many times did I call DHS? They didn't do a damn thing. Nothing. Until there was the news report. So I hear all this fancy stuff up here, and you guys don't do anything. How many times does somebody have to call them? 10, 15, 20? It's ridiculous. So my 2 minutes, I just want to say what Thomas Jefferson said. Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. Thank you for the committee, and I really hope something happens.
Thank you, Mr. Pence. Next up, we have Josh Berg. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Josh Berg. I am grateful for the opportunity to be here today, not in spite of the difficult theme of this hearing, but because of it. The issues before us matter profoundly to the people that we serve, and I'm committed to helping build a system that earns their trust and meets their needs. The recent revelations of large-scale Medicaid fraud are deeply troubling. Medicaid fraud is theft. It steals from taxpayers, from vulnerable Minnesotans who rely on essential services, and from a system already under tremendous strain. As someone who works at one of the largest ICS organizations in the state, serving low-income Minnesotans with physical disabilities and brain injuries, I believe in the highest ethical and professional standards. I support rigorous enforcement of Medicaid laws and full prosecution of those who abuse the system for personal gain. We didn't arrive here overnight. These challenges are a product of decades of evolving programs, shifting priorities, and reactive decisions, not the actions of a single administration or legislature. Now is not the time for blame or partisan rhetoric. We all share responsibility for the system as it stands, and we share the duty to fix it. Too often we are stuck in a reactive cycle, chasing the next scandal, trying to get ahead of the next Feeding Our Future headline, In doing so, we risk losing sight of the why and the who. Behind every program, every policy, every audit, there is a person, a Minnesotan, a child with autism, a young adult with cerebral palsy, a parent recovering from brain injury. We need a plan, a coordinated, thoughtful plan that strengthens programs with integrity and clarity rather than shutting them down, provides clear, consistent definitions of fraud and waste without vague interpretations or moving targets, establishes continuity of care protocols when a fraudulent provider is shut down, so housing and services aren't abruptly lost. These are not theoretical concerns. They are happening now without a plan. This moment demands seriousness and accountability, but also nuance. Not everything reported is fraud. Not everything is waste. I can connect you with providers doing excellent work within the constraints of a complex, often contradictory system. Yet many live and work in fear. Fear that shifting definitions or one disgruntled staff or client could put them in the headlines, facing investigations or payment withholds without any due process. This must stop. Let's take a breath. Let's do this work humbly. And as a friend and one of my favorite senators often says, let's leave our egos at the door. Let's be bold. Let's be brave. This will be difficult work, but we are ready. Let's make this system worthy of the people it is built to serve. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Thank you to all of our testifiers and to people watching. I just want to thank you for all the people who have reached out to us. Mr. Pence reached out to us. Other people have sent us emails through the portals. And to Mr. Berg's point, not everything is fraud, but it takes time to figure that out. But we are doing the work of trying to respond to all of the reports we receive, and we appreciate all of you. Thank you. All right, with that, we're going to start with member questions. First on the list is Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I'll be asking the Acting Commissioner and the Inspector General to join us back at the desk. I was listening to their testimony, especially preparing for the hearing, and I have a really quick and simple question to begin with today. Inspector General, what date did you start with DHS?
I think it was March 26 of 2025.
Thank you. And so just to help color a little bit more of the picture that DHS tried to paint for us today, for frame of reference, they mentioned that they had a meeting with the Attorney General's office to look into these concerns over HSS. But that came on the heels of reporting by CARE 11. Based upon what we've heard so far from the testimony given by Minnesotans in attendance today, my question for you, either one of you, is how long does it take for a Minnesotan to get a response from your agency when they have credible fraud complaints?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Thank you, Chair Robbins and Representative Schultz. I think part of this will be important for Inspector General Clark to answer as well, but I would like to say that I stepped into this role in February. I think that the reporting that A.J. Legault has been very helpful to us. It was very helpful to see the work that he did and what he uncovered, and that was part of, as I stepped into this role, and I was seeing the data and having new information coming to me as temporary commissioner, having that story was, you know, all part of the ingredients that went into us, along with that vague, credible allegation of fraud, part of the ingredients that went into me calling for a different approach to data analytics.
Madam Chair, I asked a very simple question. How long does it take DHS to respond to a complaint, a credible complaint from a Minnesotan, or in the cases of the instances and the data that we have, county entities that administer this program? How long does it take DHS to respond?
Commissioner Gandhi, please try to actually answer the question. And we're not going to allow filibusters. So if you are filibustering, we're going to just move on to another question. Thank you.
Chair Robbins, I'm sorry you're perceiving that. Representative Schultz asked about A.J. Legault's reporting and about how long it takes, so I would like Inspector General Clark to talk about that because he has been working with the Inspector General's office on past practice and the changes that he's making.
Thank you, General Clark.
To your question directly, I don't know the exact timeline, right? We have to triage, we have to assess risk, we have to prioritize. My staff tells me that in 2024, we got 1,300 reports or complaints to us. We currently have 1,000 open investigations. We just cannot actively drop everything we're doing and immediately respond to all of the complaints that are coming in. We are doing our best. We have to triage. We have to assign risk. We have to prioritize. We also refer matters to MCOs. For instance, if an MCO recipient calls us and says, I'm a UCARE recipient, fraud is going on, we refer that to UCARE, who is responsible for detecting and preventing fraud and taking action against that provider. So it's complicated. Unfortunately, I can't give you an exact timeline of how long it takes to respond to a complaint. It varies.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just note for the record that Hennepin Health, you know, is on record as having made formal complaints, not even just a, you know, individual Minnesotan concerned with fraud, but government entities, counties concerned with this, and that was in March of 2024. And yet it took until May and a reporting by CARE 11 in order to see any sort of action from the two of you who are both in positions of power to look into this for at least 2 months prior. And then concerning to me is the picture that you painted today, that you know, Inspector General Clark, that there are providers that provide services not just for housing stabilization services, but they're interwoven through a whole number of HCBS services. And I didn't hear from you today, nor do I have any level of confidence based upon the reporting from the media, that you are tracking the individuals who are involved in providing those services to those other programs. You talk about data analytics, but there is no evidence that you're applying the same principles that are happening with HSS into other Medicaid-funded programs. And I'm really concerned with that, especially when earlier today you said straight into the camera, Inspector General, you said payments will be stopped for those suspected of fraud. And then later in your remarks came back and said, I don't have the payment withhold authority. You said that. That's my concern today.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I have so many thoughts. So I appreciate that we've had two members of the public that have had really bad service come forward, and on behalf of the state of Minnesota, I apologize to you. And I know I happened to walk in with one of our testifiers because he was trying to find how to get to this room, and thank you for all you went through to even get here today. Thank you. I appreciate you. I appreciate that. I want to talk just a little bit about what happened just on Monday at the homeless encampment. So this is what happens when we don't serve people. We just heard two amazing human beings, one that has found recovery, and God bless you for finding recovery. I worked at Teen Challenge for a couple years, and I feel for you what you've been through. And it's really unfortunate that the state of Minnesota and the Health and Human Services Department let you down. But just on Monday at the homeless encampment, there was a mass shooting. And that's because these homeless people don't have a place to go. We have all of these services everywhere in state government. Just in this alone, the Housing Stabilization Service, since its inception, doled out $302 million when it was expected to have $12 million of expenditures. And very little of it, in fact, according to Joe Thompson, at a CARE 11 interview, said the vast majority of the spending of that $302 million is fraud. Now, I don't know exactly where that number lies. He might. He's doing a deep dive. Thank God for Joe Thompson, because he is investigating. He is going actually to the sites. I still haven't heard a ton about site visits, looking at the records as they exist, and doing his due diligence. And hopefully he will be, and the feds will actually take action with what's happening, because we're sorely lacking, Madam Chair, here in Minnesota. So that's one thing. I would also say that as I looked at the CARE 11 report just from September 11th, even in that report, A.J. Legault said that the agency, the inspector general, was flying blind. This is just days ago. The information that they discovered was that the information that's coming from the public, from Hennepin Health, from multiple sources, are not getting to where they need to go. And the quote was, they are literally flying blind. They saw payment to dead people, fake meetings, forged signatures, bribes, phantom services, kickbacks, fly-by-night companies. Not difficult things to see. All you had to do was show up at their door and realize that in one building alone, there were 22, I'll call them ghost providers, 22 providers in one building alone. I have a document in front of me that said that's not unique. In another building in Minneapolis, there are 20 providers. In another building, 15. Another building, 14. Two buildings have 14. There are multiple providers in the exact same location. This isn't difficult fraud. This is not rocket science. This is not complicated. This is easy stuff. I don't know why we can. I don't know how many hearings we've had and ask questions of the agency, what are you doing? And it seems like not much.
Sorry, Representative Rick, do you have a question?
Do I have a question? I did have a question. So the question, I'm going to go a different direction, is you said that the director for the Housing Stabilization Services resigned, or his term ended, or whatever term we're using. Somebody said fired. You said he wasn't fired. So explain more about that, because we're in the middle of this governor's term, even though he said he's going to run again. So how is it a deputy commissioner and the director of the Housing Stabilization Services just suddenly was no longer employed as of yesterday when the hearing is today?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, Government Data Practices Act allows me to share the dates of employment. And as you know, the legislature has put parameters around personnel data. So I'm able to tell you that as an appointed official, his appointment ended yesterday.
Representative Rick?
Right. So his appointment ended, interestingly, the day before the fraud committee, over the little department that he was running that has, according to Joe Thompson, rampant fraud. How convenient. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to start by thanking Ms. Lean and Mr. Pence for telling your story, coming forward, and helping us deal with this problem of corporate provider fraud. Nothing makes me angrier than the fact that we have these corporate private providers who have made vulnerable people a profit center. They have targeted the programs that help people. And as I think Representative Rarick said, we are seeing an overwhelming need, which is why we have heard the agencies say that they, you know, and legislators, frankly, prioritizing access and speed because of this overwhelming need. But we have decided to do this with private providers who, in many cases, have made government a profit center. And I think I heard you say this, because I've heard Drew Evans say this in, Superintendent Evans say this in public safety, I believe. We were talking about the expanded resources for the Attorney General's Medicaid fraud control unit. Is fraud has become has targeted the entire economy, private sector, public sector. It has targeted seniors and veterans and consumers, and in this case, government programs. You, Inspector General Clark, said something about, like, we need the same tools and technology as the private sector. And I'm wondering, as you think about the design questions about where we started and where we're going. Like, what about the design pieces have made us, made sort of government vulnerable as a mark for fraud? And what are the pieces that you think we need to go? I remember the other thing, I just remember Superintendent Evans, I think he'd be helpful to bring him in here and have that conversation too. He said Visa spent over 5 years, $12.5 billion in updating their systems for fraud. So it's certainly not just government, but I do think that we have a particular vulnerability because we are looking to serve people and solve these problems in a way that make us vulnerable. So I'm wondering what you think about, as you think about the same technologies and tools as the private sector, what you think we can go there.
General Clark.
Thank you, Rep. Greenman. You know, we need business technology solutions and upgrades, right? When we are being asked to do data analysis to get ahead of this fraud problem, my staff is operating out of Excel spreadsheets that we're sharing through Outlook email systems. We have antiquated systems that are not able to do predictive analytics to predict where, to see where trends are going, right? Oftentimes we are looking at data after the fact, after billing has gone out. We need data that can predict or see spikes, see trends, and we need to automate, right? We are having staff having to pull the data and look at it. We need systems to automate that. I mean, staff time and resources are limited, right? We have a limited amount of people working on this. To the extent we can automate our systems and modernize our technology, that's where we need to go. Technology is one thing. I think we also need to look at strengthening programs on the front end, right? I said greedy people, you said greedy businesses have learned how to exploit our systems. I'm sick of it. We need to think about what we can do on the front end to prevent these greedy people and businesses from gaining access to our programs. We need to look at mandatory trainings for all providers, anti-fraud trainings. I ideally would like them to be in person. Come in person and hear about fraud and how we're going to watch you and how you're going to be held accountable. I would like to require all staff to, that enroll to get a billing ID number, right, so that we can track them through data, track individuals through claims, right? If you don't have a unique identifier, we can't see maybe you're billing over here fraudulently, you're billing over here. We need to connect our systems. One way to do that would be to give everybody a unique billing ID. I think we need to look at all of our human services statutes to put clear language about billing caps in our statute so that everybody is on notice about what is acceptable for billing and what is not. I also think it's important to think about the idea of wet ink signatures on treatment records, right? We want recipients to have to verify and sign off that services are actually being provided. We do that in some statutes, like the personal care assistant statute. We require the individual recipient to sign off and verify that services were provided. We don't do that in some other program. Right? So like ICS, there's no requirement that the recipient actually sign off and say, yep, you're billing this. This is true and correct. So I think, right, technology is one thing, right? But then you're still talking about working after the fact, right? After money has gone out, pay and chase, right? We need to be looking at how to make our program stronger so that these people don't gain access in the first place. And I talked a lot about technology, but I'd really like to partner with you all and the legislator to think about fixes that we can do to prevent people from gaining access to these programs. Some of those are legislative fixes, like I said, wet ink signatures on treatment records. That could be a start.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate that because that was actually where my second question was going, is I actually really appreciate and I actually see new leadership not as a liability but as an asset. I think what we are seeing is leadership, whether it's a temporary commissioner, whether it's Inspector General Clark. I hope we have a new assistant commissioner who is as committed to both doing the things that we have been doing, which is trying to a certain degree harden the target of government to this, to think about how do we actually change the business model? Because what we shouldn't have to improve the time it takes for someone to complain, we should make it so people don't have to complain. And what I see is, as we look at this, and this is the question for what we should be doing on this committee, is we have seen because we have outsourced all these services, I mean, 300,000 providers, because we have outsourced all of these services, we have turned, one, we have left ourselves very, very vulnerable in the same way that we look across the economy, but we also have not been able to do the redesign because we have, frankly, been focused all our time on how you can more manage all of those contracts and all of that pre-vetting. What would it look like if we did this differently? And I know this, is, to me, is the work of this committee. I know that if we are looking at best practices from other states, maybe even other countries, if we are looking at different models of service that takes the profit motive and the profit center out of the provision of services, that we could be doing the job. And I know that that doesn't make for great sound bites, and it doesn't make for great fundraising emails, and it's not a good platform to run for office, but it is our work here. And so I am wondering, like, how we could use this committee, because we don't mark up bills. Like, so far, mostly what we have done is just ask angry questions and I think try to get press. But what I want to see us do is think about how do we take on that business model and think about how government could be doing this differently, that the public could be doing this differently so that publicly provided services are publicly accountable and potentially publicly provided. And we've talked about this over and over and over again, but I think this really puts a fine point on it, because we have to be able to meet the needs of our communities, and we have to do it in a way that doesn't create a vector for private sector fraud, whether it's United Healthcare or it is an individual provider with 15 offices. We have seen fraud in all those cases. United Health is being investigated for Medicaid fraud. And so there is one through line here. Very diverse set of entities, very diverse set of people. It's happening all over the country. The through line is they have made government a profit center, and that I think we should say is unacceptable. So I'm wondering what you think we should be thinking about doing as policymakers, and as people can actually say the system isn't working as it is, well, we should change it. What should we be looking at? What model should we be looking at? What should we be exploring in that vein?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. I would like to quickly just thank Ms. Lean and Mr. Pence for coming forward with their, just very quickly thank them for coming forward. I think that we are looking at changes at DHS to how to respond more quickly and close the loop. I want them to know that what they did share with AJ Legault and us did make a difference. And I'd like Inspector General to share what he can in terms of the results. And we are looking at the way that we've approached housing stabilization services. We are also looking at other Medicaid programs. So we are using the same playbook.
General Clark.
Thank you. Rep. Greenman, I sincerely want to work on solutions to these problems, right? This Medicaid fraud, seeing these people get rich off the backs of taxpayers, off the backs of vulnerable Minnesotans, makes me just as mad as all of you. I want to work with you on solutions. So when we're thinking about solutions to the problem, and Rep. Greenman, thinking about whether or not it makes sense to open these programs to the private sector, I think HSS, this is my personal opinion, HSS is a perfect example. Why did we let these private companies provide these services, which are traditional county social worker case management services? Why didn't we fund counties to provide these services, to have more trained, licensed social workers provide services to help people transition from homelessness to new housing, to help people, when they get housing, stay in their housing? Instead of funding providers who actually, have compassion, have been doing this work, have licensed, capability social workers, we open it up to unvetted private businesses. And so that, I think that's a design flaw. Those are issues I want to work with you all about, identifying those design flaws and how we can fix these programs.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think first I just have to speak in defense of our committee's existence, because we've repeatedly heard during these hearings comments from our colleagues on the other side of the table undermining the integrity and necessity to have this committee and continually pivoting to the idea that the only thing a legislative committee ever does is mark up bills. We have presentations, we have informational discussions, we talk as members, and we're talking about important things. We're talking about matters of public policy. This is how the public has its conversation, and they know that. So that's step one. Step two, profit motive. We need to get rid of profit motive. Profit motive is what makes this not happen in the private sector. If I don't get what I expect from a business, they don't get paid. That's why they have the incentive to give me what I expect. What we've done with this program from top to bottom is completely remove that. We've created an incentive structure that invites 115 providers to engage in bad action, $100 million to go out the door. Currently, 1,000 open investigations, 1,300 reports. That's an indication of an incentive structure to do what we're hearing about today. And that structure isn't an accident. It didn't sprout out of the ground. It was created. It was designed. This body and this administration constructed it. And it's very fascinating to me, this point that keeps getting brought up about private businesses, and there's kind of like an undercurrent of disparagement of if you're in private business, you're inherently untrustworthy. But let's be specific about who's doing this. This isn't just the categorically businesses. These are specific people who are using the mechanisms of business in order to take public dollars in a way that's very obvious to them. We have a running car with the keys in it, unattended, and we're surprised when it gets stolen. And you ask a very good question, General Clark. Why are we doing it this way? Why are we engaging with private businesses, private entities, non-governmental people to provide these services when there's probably a better way? And that's a really, really important question to focus on, because what has the response been from your former boss in particular, Keith Ellison? The response has been in conversations that we have on audio with people who were later convicted of engaging in these activities, an abiding concern for them remaining in business. Almost as if the program itself was constructed to put them in business. Apparently wasn't constructed to help people, because that has not been the abiding concern. If it was, you wouldn't have two testifiers coming here today saying, help me, why won't you help me? I simply refuse to believe that these outcomes are an accident. And the accusation of, oh, this is just a show, this is all about campaign politics, this is about people's lives, including the taxpayer, to whom this costs a great deal of money. So maybe it is worth a little performative anger, quote unquote, to address properly. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a few additional questions. We may go over 11:30 time, so just giving you a little warning. I want to drill down on the internal controls. Time and time again, the problem is that the money goes out the door, and as you said, we can prosecute them on the outside. Law enforcement, they're doing a fantastic job, but if we're paying and chasing, we are not getting the money back. And so there's been some discussion about some areas of failure of internal controls, but I wonder, do you have a list of specific places where we haven't checked provider eligibility? Who's responsible for that? Why isn't it happening properly? Recipient eligibility. We have numerous reports of people being getting services paid for on their behalf when they were dead, when they were incarcerated, when they were in treatment. So who is responsible for checking provider eligibility, recipient eligibility, and also, I get that we need tech solutions. I'm on board, and I will be a partner with you on that. We did spend $40 million in the last biennium towards addressing that, and I know that work is going on right now to identify providers to help with the new upgrades. But nevertheless, the recipients have found this, getting their own billing records. The reporters have found it by showing up at different locations. Our staff put together this handout that all of you can read. We're just looking at Hennepin County. They found the HCBS licenses, and they identified 22 at one single address, 20 at one address. And I'm making this available to you, and I will send you the unredacted copy with the names of the providers. Like, this took our staff a half an hour just to do the data research. Not a half an hour, half a day, I'm sorry. So this is doable right now. And so I appreciate that, if we can't get to it in this hearing, what I would like to have from you in a follow-up meeting is a list of all the places of internal controls, provider eligibility, who's doing it, recipient eligibility, who's doing it, who is managing the flow. We saw just in the spreadsheet of how much the increase was over time in billing. Our staff has put that together for you here for those in Hennepin County. You see dramatic increases in billing in 23 and 24. Like, that's knowable right now. So based on this, I would like a general answer about the layers of internal controls you're looking at, but I would like a specific answer. And then I have a follow-up after that. Thank you. Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, thank you for that. Would be happy to work with you on that. This is part of the work that we've been doing the last 7 months. We have been, like I said, doing the data analysis on the different services that are in Medicaid, and then we also have a multidisciplinary team looking at program integrity, which really needs to begin at the conception of legislation and go all the way through post-payment review and outcomes and have internal controls throughout. I will tell you that we have some internal controls, but it is not sufficient. We need more. And so our team is developing a program integrity playbook where we will continue to improve. And coming from the private sector, I think we also need a private sector review, as is in the executive order, looking at the gaps analysis and what we could do better, because it's always hard to evaluate your own work.
Thank you. Commissioner Gandhi, you keep referring to that you've only been in the job 7 months and that you're taking on this review. What was your job previous to being acting commissioner?
Previous to being acting commissioner, I was deputy commissioner. And before that, I was assistant commissioner, and before that, chief compliance officer.
And so you have been in these roles of having a compliance oversight role for how many years?
I was compliance officer from 2017 to 2021. And the compliance officer role is distinct from program integrity and the fraud work that's done. One of the things that we're looking at in our new work and my ability to reorganize the department is to integrate that so it's not siloed.
I'm glad to hear that. We need to step that up. Like, today, we have all these theories and plans and working groups. Now the governor announced another working group today. Like, we just need to stop the fraud on the front end, and we need to know people are doing the due diligence that our staff was able to do, that reporters have been able to do, that citizens have been able to do, that the department doesn't seem able to do. So to your point, Inspector General, I really like your ideas about the wet ink signatures and some of the very specific things you gave us. I would like to follow up with you on that for legislation. but I would like to understand, why can't you do that now?
In like what? So each, so if you look at chapter 256B, right, the Medicaid statute, like each of the services has a subdivision of that statute, which talks about like documentation requirements, enrollment requirements for providers, eligibility requirements, right? So like the personal care assistance, for an example, it talks about the requirement that providers need to have specific records, specific requirements, time in, time out, dates of services, signed off by recipients, signed off by the staff member under penalty of perjury that fraud has not been committed on this treatment record, right? That same language does not exist for documentation requirements across chapter 256B.
Does it have to be in statute, or could you just do that? You could put that requirement on all programs. Am I not correct?
I don't have a definitive answer to that. I don't believe so. I don't think that the statutes require what documentation requirements are. So for like HSS, right? It had the provider enrollment requirements and it had the documentation requirements. In this last legislative session, we sought a fix, right, to change the documentation requirements and to change the provider enrollment requirements. So I think there do need to be legislative fixes to those statutes that outline what documents providers are supposed to keep when they're providing services. So I'm willing to partner with you on that. Happy to try to get you a definitive answer, but I do think that there are legislative changes that would help strengthen these programs.
Terrific. I would love to do a follow-up meeting, because my understanding from talking to the feds is that you have more authority. Even if the statute doesn't require it, you are still able to do that. But perhaps that's not true. So let's get together and look at those requirements and find ways to draft a bill to strengthen that for next session.
I sincerely want to partner with you on these issues.
Terrific. And then my last question so you talked about how you've changed the model, and in housing stabilization services, you are stopping payment before the investigation is complete when there are credible allegations of fraud. To Ms. Lean's question, she asked us to ask it, what defines, in your mind, the credible allegation of fraud? And then secondly, are you applying that standard to integrated community services and other programs? I see this as the general said. There are tentacles into lots of programs where the same business model of fraud is happening. So are you applying that only in housing stabilization services, or are you applying it across all the programs? Commissioner.
Chair Robbins, thank you for asking that, because I know we talked about that earlier. Yes, that is being applied across all program areas. Credible allegation of fraud is defined in statute, I believe, and I don't know, Inspector General Clark, if there's anything you want to add. We are applying it. The other piece I wanted to add is that, as he mentioned, we are looking. When there is a provider, for example, that's in HSS, and we know that they are linked, or they are also a provider for another type of service, our team is looking across all of those and taking action, because if you are committing fraud in one program, most likely we have enough information to determine credible allegation of fraud in other areas as well.
General Clark.
So to answer your question, the standard for what is a credible allegation of fraud is laid out in statute, right? I don't have the specific subpart, but it's in chapter 256B, right? So when we're thinking about fraud, we're thinking about an intentional, right? These aren't mistakes, right? An intentional wrongdoing, intentional theft. Like fraud is a crime, right? It's our job when there's allegations of fraud, right, to stop payments, refer to law enforcement. It's law enforcement's job to prosecute ultimately in a court of law whether or not that fraud actually occurred. But to answer your question, we are applying the same standards across the board the work we're doing with HSS. In the past several weeks, fraud allegations have been brought to my attention with certain ICS providers, and we are suspending payments to those providers.
So in addition to the 115 in HHS, how many other providers have you suspended payments on?
I would have to follow up and give you I don't know off the top of my head. I mean, since I've been there, it's more than just the HSS providers.
Okay. Please do update the entire committee on that, and maybe you could give us a monthly update so that we stay in the loop while we're out of session.
And I think that is very important. I mean, I understand there's data practices limitations, but I think it's important for us to be transparent with the public about the work that we're doing, to instill confidence in the work that we're doing, that we are actually taking aggressive action against providers and shutting off money where we see signs of fraud. So happy to work with you, get you the information you need.
Thank you. And I know you want to go lead Pinto, but Mr. Johnson has the actual definition from statute, so I'm turning to Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, it's 256B.064. It's in subdivision 2, paragraph 2, clause 2, and it says that allegations are considered credible when they have an indicum of reliability, and the state agency has reviewed all allegations, facts, and evidence carefully and acts judiciously on a case-by-case basis. Credible allegation of fraud is an allegation which has been verified by the state from any source, including but not limited to fraud hotline complaints, claims data mining, and patterns identified through provider audits, civil false claims cases, and law enforcement investigations.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I was at the ready with answers. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I actually had that pulled up, too, and was going to act as your researcher, but we had our actual researcher provide it. And maybe I'll just note in reference to that, so that's actually a pretty high standard. So, and I really do also thank the two testifiers for what they shared. I think the way the statute is written, what Ms. Lean, when she called in, that maybe wouldn't qualify under the law that we pass. So that might be something where we actually would want to. Well, just in the sense that it says that the agency, it's only after the agency reviews everything and has various corroboration, like it's not just the person who calls in, at least as I read this, that might be something to explore and make changes. That's obviously up to the legislature to decide what qualifies. So I want to make sure, and I'll note that part of the reason that that's may have been set at somewhat high is the tension that Representative Rarick's question or comment alluded to of providing services to people who are extremely vulnerable and not wanting to cut off funding too quickly to that, because we want to make sure that folks, in fact, get helped out of homelessness, while at the same time, of course, making sure to act to prevent fraud and prevent money going out wrongly. I have a question and then a comment. And the question is, I guess I have the sense that there really were flaws in the design of the program from the beginning, as we look back retrospectively in terms of how the legislature passed the program. There were weaknesses compared to other programs, and I'm just wondering if the Inspector General could comment on that, sort of what sorts of weaknesses there were, if in fact I'm correct in asking that question.
Thank you.
General Clark.
My assessment, right, after being at DHS for a few months now, right, is that it was just simply too easy for providers to enroll in the Housing Stabilization Services Program. The vetting in statute, it was you fill out some forms, pass a background check, and essentially you can become a Housing Stabilization Service provider. Now, I think that's an important point to note, right? We are doing criminal background checks on all of these providers, all of the owners. So these are people without a criminal history that can get into our programs and then are deciding to steal from us. So if you look at the requirements for provider eligibility and enrollment right in the original HSS statute and then compare that to some of the other Medicaid programs, I think you'll see, right, again, going at to personal care assistance, a lengthy list of specific qualifications, requirements that are needed to enroll, right? For PCA, we required people to be bonded. We required mandatory training in statute. We required a qualified professional, either qualified through education or some type of professional licensure to be, you know, on the staff of a personal care assistance agencies. Those same, like, barriers to entry were just not there in Housing Stabilization Services. I think we need to look at barriers to entry to keep fly-by-night providers out of our programs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and then just a comment in part in response to comments made by others, and also, and that was very helpful information, Inspector General. There was a question of sort of why the program was designed in that way then, and why have these private providers come in? And I'll just note the program was passed by actually Republican House, Republican Senate. It was actually a member of the current House GOP who was the House author. I believe though proposed by the Dayton administration. So recognizing the number of folks at that point, I assume part of the thinking of that was exactly the point that Representative Rarick had made, was making sure that folks in vulnerable positions are being supported as much as possible. I think we can look back and say that was a flawed design. That was not a good way to design the program. We understand the reasons for it. They've been brought up in the course of this hearing, and yet it's something that we need to make sure, and I'm really glad that there have been, and even the tightening through the Human Services Committee this session. But there's a tension there. There's also a tension among members, as the Inspector General referenced early on, about acting very quickly to stop payment, but potentially alerting fraudsters. Madam Chair, you made the reference that maybe there's a way to get around that. But for now, that's something that I think also explains one of the challenges. I work outside the legislature as a prosecutor, and I absolutely understand the concern that you're going to alert somebody really glad to stop the payment. I want to hold them accountable and potentially send them to jail, have a criminal conviction, and that's going to require, as the Inspector General knows, a higher standard, a lot of evidence. So there's a tension there. There was a comment that the profit motive is why this doesn't happen in the private sector. And I will direct members' attention to Drew Evans' testimony a number of hearings ago, talking about, I think he said that Visa has identified $333 billion, $350 billion worth of private sector fraud. The Visa sees this is a growing concern for corporations, for individuals. This is happening, in fact, in the private sector, and we know this is a case where the program had this design tension built within it. And then the final tension that I see, and this referenced is referencing the committee. No doubt at all that we need to be focusing on program integrity and on fraud in our public programs. I found a challenge for that in this seat, that as we're diving deep in these human services programs, it's our colleagues who have the expertise and actually can, what I want to do is be able to say to them, hey, these are changes that you should be making in your programs. And that's the piece that I found very challenging in this committee. I would say that while it's true we've heard a couple of bills informationally, we have not had bills referred to us. That's what I said at the beginning, nor have we voted on bills. And there's a real challenge in having an insight into what is happening in this area. So that's the tension that I'm seeing as well, that there's tensions throughout this. No doubt at all that program integrity is an incredibly important topic. That's exactly the reason we want to make sure that we're doing so in as effective a way as possible. And members, I'm sorry that I don't see that happening. So I appreciate the testifiers, and I think we just need to continue pushing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So members, we have two people left on the question list, one from the friends on the DFL and one from the Republican side. Is there a consensus that we allow those last two questions? Because I know I'm holding us over. Is that okay? All right. Therefore, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to respond to one of the comments that Representative Hudson made about, you know, the private sector. I spent the last 25 years of my career doing information technology design and development work for a wide variety of private sector firms. And what I would say is that if any of these employers or clients had allowed their IT systems to deteriorate to the degree to which we have allowed DHS systems to deteriorate, none of them would be in business today. You made the point about, well, how can Hennepin County produce this chart and DHS can't? I've met with the IT people at Hennepin County, and aside from the crummy DHS systems they were required to use to administer these programs, Hennepin County has much better analytical capabilities than DHS has had. You posed the question about, well, why can't we figure out why, you know, when people are dead, why are we paying benefits to dead people? Well, I have met with the IT staff at the Department of Health, so the Registrar of Records at the Department of Health is the source of truth for births and deaths in the state. And the IT people at MDH think it's completely appropriate for them to stand up what's called a data service that would allow DHS or another agency to just query a system and get back an answer to the question, is this person still alive? I've had the same conversation with the people, IT staff at Deed. They think that it's perfectly appropriate that instead of DHS workers having to key employment and income information off a paycheck stub, that they ought to be able to send a query to a deed system and get the current employment and income information for a person in real time as well. But we don't allow that. We're requiring people to key information into a 1980s era DOS system that doesn't, put the information into a form that, Mr. Clark and his team can use to ferret out these issues. So I cannot emphasize enough the fact that we need to come up with a plan and make the investments that are required in our IT infrastructure to enable what we want to happen.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Andrews.
Thank you. And Representative Elkins, I completely agree with you on that. So, and I don't know the history of, if there's some proposals, I don't know. But, we have to function much better because clearly we're not. And I would encourage, we're the legislative branch. You are the administrative branch. And, your role is to carry out all these programs and to set rulemaking and to make sure there's no fraud and to do what needs to be done so things are properly administered. And if that means IT systems, if that means, actually creating rules so that you can stop this, if that means when you have a credible allegation of fraud, which I would argue Ms. Lean had the data and sent the data in or attempted to send the data, and that is a credible allegation of fraud with the data, which was not acted on until there was a TV news story on it. But things like connecting agencies, if there is a credible allegation of fraud on a provider within DHS program X, they should be cut off of every other program in every agency and let the counties know if they're trying to get dollars. That's how you stop some of this. But when you're allowing them to then just bill somewhere else, I mean, that's crazy. That would never happen in what I would call the real world. And we have to function in the real world. The other thing I want to bring up, we talked about we've only had a few bills through here. We should have more, I believe. I believe that this committee should be looking at any bills that deal with fraud in the future, and I would hope that changes next year. So thank you for coming in. Like I said last time, you have a lot of work ahead of you, and I hope you're successful at it. So
thank you. Yeah. Me too.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you, members and the public, for indulging us in going over. I appreciate everyone's contributions to this discussion, and I look forward to following up as we discussed in the hearing. We are adjourned.